On this day, in 1802, the painter Methodia Rascal dropped the glittering thing in the deepest well he knew. No one would ever hear it down there. The chicken chased him home. It would be a lot simpler, Vimes thought, if this was a story. A sword is pulled out of a stone, or a magic ring is flung into the depths of the sea, and with general rejoicing the world turns. But this was real life. The world didn't turn. It just went into a spin. It was Combe Valley Day, and there wasn't a battle going on in Combe Valley. But what was going on here wasn't peace, either. What was going on? Well, what was going on was committees. It was negotiation. Actually, as far as he could tell, it hadn't even got as far as negotiation yet. It hadn't got past talks about meetings about delegations. On the other hand, no one had died, except maybe of boredom. There was a lot of history to be unpicked, and for those who weren't actually engaged in that delicate activity, there was Combe Valley to tame. Two cultural heroes were down there in the cavern, and all it needed was one good storm and a few misplaced blockages for a white flood laden with grinding boulders to wipe the whole place away. It hadn't happened yet, but sooner or later the dynamic geography would get around to it. Combe Valley couldn't be left to its own devices, not any more. Everywhere you looked, there were teams of trolls and dwarfs, surveying, diverting, damming and drilling. They'd been engaged in this for 2 days, but it would take them forever, because every winter changed the game. Combe Valley was forcing cooperation on them. Damn Combe Valley. Vimes thought that was a bit too pat, but nature can be like that. Sometimes you got sunset so pink they had no style at all. One thing that had happened fast was the tunnel. Dwarfs had cut down quickly through the soft limestone. You could stroll down into the cavern now, though in fact you'd have to queue because of the long line of trolls and dwarfs. Those in the line going down eyed one another with uncertainty at best. Those in the line coming up sometimes looked angry, or were close to tears, or just walked along looking at the ground. Once they got past the exit, they tended to form into quiet groups. Sam, with young Sam in his arms, didn't have to queue. News had got around. He went straight in, past the trolls and dwarfs who were painstakingly reassembling the broken stalagmites. It was news to Vimes that you could do that, but apparently, if you came back in 500 years, they'd be as good as new. And into what had come to be called the King's Cave. And there they were. You couldn't argue with it. There was the dwarf king, slumped forward across the board, glazed by the eternal drip, his beard now rock and at one with the stone. But the diamond king had remained upright in death, his skin gone cloudy, and you could still see the game in front of him. It was his move. A healthy little stalactite hung from his outstretched hand. They'd broken off small stalagmites to make the pieces, which time had now glued into immobility. The scratched lines on the stone board were more or less invisible, but thud players from both races had already pored over it, and a sketch of the dead king's game had by now appeared in the Times. The diamond king was playing the dwarf side. Apparently, it could go either way. People were saying that when this was all over, they'd seal the cave. Too many people in a living cave killed it in some way, the dwarfs said, and then the kings would be left in the dark to finish their game in, with luck, peace. Water dripping on a stone, changing the shape of the world one drop at a time, washing away a valley. Yes, well, Vimes had added to himself. But it would never be that simple, and for every new generation you'd have to open it again so that people could see that it was true. Today, though, it was open for Sam and young Sam, who was wearing a fetching woolly hat with a bobble on it. Brick and Sally were on duty, along with a couple of dwarfs and 2 more trolls, all watching the stream of visitors and one another. Worms covered the ceiling. The game gleamed. What would young Sam remember? Probably just the glitter. But it had to be done. The players were genuine. On that, at least, both sides agreed. The carvings on diamond were accurate. The armour and jewellery on blood axe were just as history recorded. Even the long loaf of dwarf bread that he carried into battle, and which could shatter a troll's skull, was by his side. Dwarf scholars had, with delicacy and care, and the blunting of 15 saw blades, removed a tiny slice of it. Miraculously, it had turned out to be still as edible now as the day it was baked. Which tells you everything you need to know about dwarf bread. A minute was about enough for this historic moment, Vimes decided. Young Sam was at the grabbing age, and he'd never hear the end of it if his son ate an historic monument. "Can I have a word, Lance Constable?" he said to Sally, as he turned to go. "The guard changes in a minute."
"Certainly, sir," said Sally.
Vimes strolled off to a corner of the cavern and waited until Nobby and Fred Colon marched in at the head of the relief. "Glad you joined, Lance Constable," he said as she hurried up.
"Very much, sir."
"Good. Shall we go up into the daylight?" She followed him up the slope and into the damp warmth of Coombe Valley, where he sat down on a boulder. He looked at her while young Sam played at his feet. He said, "Is there anything you'd like to say to me, Lance Constable?"
"Should there be, sir?"
"I can't prove anything, of course," said Vimes. "But you are an agent of the Low King, aren't you? You've been spying on me." He waited while she considered the options. Swallows swooped overhead in squadrons.
"I wouldn't put it quite like that, sir," she said eventually. "I was keeping an eye on Hamcrasher, and I'd heard about the mining, and then when it all started to heat up—"
"Becoming a watchman seemed a good idea, right? Did the League know?"
"No. Look, sir, I wasn't spying on you."
"You told him I was headed for Coombe Valley. And the night we arrived, you went for a little fly-around, just stretching your wings?"
"Look, this isn't my life," said Sally. "I'd joined the new force in Bionk. We're trying to make a difference up there. I did want to come to Ankh-Morpork anyway, because, well, we all want to. To learn, you know, how you managed to do it. Everyone speaks highly of you. And then the Low King summoned me, and I thought, where's the harm? Hamcrasher has caused trouble up there, too. I never actually told you a lie, sir."
"Rhys already knew about the secret, right?" said Vimes.
"No, sir, not as such. But I think he suspected there was something down there."
"Then why didn't he just go and look?"
"Dwarfs digging around in Coombe Valley. The trolls would go spare, sir."
"But not if the dwarfs were merely investigating why a copper from Ankh-Morpork was chasing some fleeing criminals into the caves, right? Not if the copper was good old Sam Vimes, who everyone knows is as straight as an arrow, even if he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. You can't bribe Sam Vimes, but why bother when you can pull the wool over his eyes?"
"Look, sir, I know how you must feel, but, well, there's your little boy there playing in Coombe Valley with trolls and dwarfs all around, and they're not fighting, right? I didn't lie. I just liaised a little. Wasn't it worth it, sir?" "Hut, you really worried them when you went to the wizards. Shine hadn't left the city. Rhys had to fly him in by night. All they really did was follow your lead. The only person who fooled you was me, and it turns out I wasn't very good at it. They needed you, sir. Look around and say it wasn't worth it."
100 yards away, a house-sized rock rumbled across the stone, pushed and steered by a dozen trolls, dropped into a sinkhole and blocked it like an egg in a cup. There was a cheer.
"Can I mention something else, sir?" said Sally. "I do know Angua is standing behind me."
"It's Sergeant Angua to you," said Angua by her ear. "You didn't fool me, either. I told you we didn't like snitches in the watch. But for what it's worth, sir, she smells like she's telling the truth." "Do you still have a route to the Low King?" said Vimes.
"Yes, and I'm sure he'll—"
Sally began quickly. "These are my demands. The Grags and what's left of their guards are coming back to Ankh-Morpork with me. That includes Ardent, though I'm told it'll be weeks before he can talk again. They're going before Vetinari. I've got promises to keep, and no one is going to stop me. It'll be tough to make any big charges stick, but I'm bloody well going to try. And since I'll bet my dinner that Vetinari is in on all this, I expect he'll pack them off back to Rhys in any case. I imagine he's got a cell that's deep enough for comfort, understood?"
"Yes, sir. And the other demands?"
"The same as that one, repeated in a louder voice," said Vimes.
"Understood?" "Absolutely, sir." "Then I'll resign, of course," said Sally.
Vimes's eyes narrowed. "You'll resign when I tell you to, Lance Constable. You took the King's shilling, remember? And made an oath. Go and liaise."
"You're going to keep her?" said Angua, watching the vampire disappear into the distance.
"You said yourself she's a good copper. We'll see." "Oh, don't make that face, Sergeant. It's all the rage in politics these days, spying on your friends. That's what I'm told. Like she said, look around."
"This is a bit unlike you, sir," said Angua, giving him a look of concern.
"Yes, it is, isn't it?" said Vimes. "I had a nice sleep last night. It's a nice day. No one is actively trying to kill me, which is nice. Thank you, Sergeant. Have a nice evening."
Vimes carried young Sam back in late afternoon light. Just as well the girl had been working for Rhys. Things might have been a bit tricky otherwise. That was the plain fact of it. Keep her on. Maybe. She'd been very useful, even Angua admitted. Besides, he'd been practically forced to take on a spy in times of more or less war. If he played that right, no one would ever again dictate to him who he took on in the watch. Doreen Winkings could rattle her false canines as much as she liked. Was this how Vetinari thought all the time? He heard his name being called. A coach was coming across the rock, and Sybil was waving from the window. That was another step forward. Even wagons could get up here now.
"You haven't forgotten the dinner tonight, have you?" she said, a hint of suspicion in her voice.
"No, dear." Vimes hadn't, but he'd hoped that it might evaporate if he didn't think about it. It was going to be official, with both kings and lots of important lesser kings and clan leaders, and the special envoy from Ankh-Morpork, unfortunately. That would be Sam Vimes scrubbed up. At least there weren't going to be tights and plumes. Even Sybil hadn't been that far-sighted. Regrettably, though, the town had a decent tailor who'd been very keen to use all that gold braid he'd bought by accident a couple of years ago.
"Willikins will have a bath run by the time we get back," said Sybil, as the coach moved away.
"Yes, dear," said Vimes.
"Don't look so glum. You'll be upholding the honour of Ankh-Morpork, remember?"
"Really, dear? What shall I do with the other hand?" said Vimes, settling back into the seat.
"Oh, Sam, tonight you'll walk with kings."
"I'd sooner be walking all by myself along Treacle Mine Road at 3 in the morning," Vimes thought. "In the rain, with the gutters gushing." But it was a wife thing. She took such a pride in him, he could never work out why. He looked down at his arm. He'd sorted that out at least. Exit wound indeed. It was just the way the burning oil had splashed on his skin. It might look a bit like that damn symbol, enough to put the wind up the dwarfs, but no floaty eyeball was going to get past him. Common sense and facts, that's what worked. After a while, it dawned on him that they weren't going into the town. They'd gone down almost as far as the lakes, but now they were headed back up on the cliff path. He could see the valley below them, opening out. The kings were working their subjects hard, on the basis that tired warriors are less keen to fight. Teams swarmed over the rock like ants. Maybe there was a plan. There probably was. But the mountains would sneer at it every winter. You'd have to have squads here all the time. You'd need to scout the mountainsides to find and smash the big boulders before they cause trouble. Remember Coombe Valley, because if you don't, your history is history. And maybe, behind the thunder and in the roar of the waters flowing underground, you'll hear the laughter of dead kings. The coach came to a halt. Sybil opened the door.
"Get down, Sam Vimes," she said. "No arguing. It's time for your portrait."
"Out here, but it's..." Vimes began.
"Good afternoon, Commander," said Otto Shriek cheerfully, appearing at the doorway. "I have set up a bench, and the light is just right for colour."
Vimes had to admit that it was. Thunderlight made the mountains gleam like gold. In the middle distance, the tears of the king fell in a line of glittering silver. Brightly coloured birds skimmed through the air, and all the way up the valley there were rainbows. Coombe Valley on Coombe Valley Day. He'd had to be there.
"If her ladyship will be seated with the little boy on her lap, and you, Commander, standing with your hand on her shoulder..."
He bustled around his big black iconograph.
"He's up here taking pictures for the Times," Sybil whispered. "And I thought, well, it's now or never. Portraiture must move on."
"How long is this going to take?" said Vimes.
"Oh, about a fraction of a second, Commander," said Otto.
Vimes brightened up. This was more like it. Of course, it never is. But it was a warm afternoon, and Vimes still felt good. They sat and stared with those fixed grins people wear when they're wondering why a fraction of a second takes half an hour, while Otto tried to get the universe sorted out to his satisfaction.
"Havelock will be wondering how to reward you, you know," murmured Sybil, as the vampire fussed around.
"He can go on wondering," said Vimes. "I've everything I want," he smiled. Click.
60 new officers," said Lord Vetinari.
"The price of peace, sir," said Captain Carrot earnestly. "I'm sure that Commander Vimes wouldn't settle for anything less. We are really stretched."
60 men, and dwarfs and trolls, obviously, is more than a third of your current complement," said the patrician, tapping his walking stick on the cobbles. "Peace comes with a rather large bill, Captain."
"And a few dividends, sir," Carrot said.
They looked up at the circle and bar symbol over the door of the mine, just above the yellow and black rope used by the watch to warn off intruders.
"The mine falls to us by default," said Vetinari.
"Apparently, sir. I believe the term is eminent domain."
"Ah, yes. That means
theft by the government, said Vetinari. But the Grags bought the freehold, sir. They're hardly going to contest it now.
Quite. And the dwarfs really can make watertight tunnels?
Oh, yes.
The trick is almost as old as mining. Would you care to step inside? I'm afraid the elevator is not working at the moment, though.
Lord Vetinari inspected the rails and the little carts the dwarfs had used to shift spoil. He felt the dry walls. He went back upstairs and frowned as a one-ton slab of iron came through the wall, whirled past his face, passed through the opposite wall, and buried itself in the street outside.
"And was that supposed to happen?" he said, brushing plaster dust off his robe.
An excited voice behind him shouted,
"A dork! It's impossible! Amazing!"
A figure climbed through the wall, holding something in one hand. He rushed up to Captain Carrot, vibrating with excitement.
"It spins once every 6.9 seconds, but the torque is immense. It broke the clamp. What powers it?"
"No one seems to know," said Carrot.
"In Oberwald."
"Excuse me, what is this about?" said Lord Vetinari, holding out a hand imperiously.
The man glanced at him and then turned to Carrot.
"Who's this?" he said.
"Lord Vetinari, ruler of the city, may I present Mr. Pony of the Artificers Guild?" said Carrot quickly. "Please let his lordship see the axle, Mr. Pony."
"Thank you," said Vetinari.
He took the thing, which looked very like two cubes, each about 6 inches on a side, joined together on one face, like a pair of dice joined at the sixes. In relation to the other, one turned very, very slowly.
"Oh," he said flatly, "a mechanism, how nice."
"Nice," said Pony. "Don't you understand? It won't stop turning."
Carrot and Pony looked expectantly at the patrician, who said,
"And that's a good thing, is it?"
Carrot coughed.
"Yes, sir. One of these drives one of the biggest mines in Oberwald. All the pumps, the fans that move the air, the trucks that haul the ore, the bellows for the forges, the elevators, everything. Just one of those. It's another type of device, like the cubes." "We don't know how they're made. They're very rare. But the other three I've heard of have not stopped working for hundreds of years. They don't use fuel. They don't need anything. They appear to be millions of years old. No one knows what made them. They just turn."
"How interesting," said Vetinari.
"Hauling trucks. Underground, you say?"
"Oh, yes," said Carrot. "Even with miners in."
"I shall give this some thought,"
said Vetinari, avoiding Mr. Pony's outstretched hand.
"And what could we make it do in this city?"
He and Carrot turned questioning faces to Mr. Pony, who shrugged and said,
"Everything!"
Plink went a drop of water onto the head of the very, very late King Bloodaxe.
"How long are we going to have to do this, Sarge?" said Nobby, as they watched the line of visitors shuffle past the dead kings.
"Mr. Vames has sent for another squad from home," said Fred Coron, shifting from one foot to the other. It seemed quite warm when you first came into the cave, but after a while the clamminess could get a man down. He reflected that Nobby wasn't affected by this, being blessed by nature with natural clammy.
"It's starting to give me the creeps, Sarge," said Nobby, indicating the kings. "If that hand moves, I'm going to scream."
"Think of it as being there, Nobby."
"I've always been somewhere, Sarge."
"Yeah, but when they comes to write the history books, they'll..."
Fred Coron paused for thought. He had to admit they probably wouldn't mention him and Nobby.
"Will, your tawnee will be proud of you anyway."
"I think that's not to be, Sarge," said Nobby sadly. "She's a nice girl, but I think I'm going to have to let her down lightly."
"Surely not."
"'Fraid so, Sarge. She cooked me dinner the other day. She tried to make distressed pudding like my old mum used to make."
Plink.
Fred Coron smiled all the way from his stomach.
"Oh, yes. No one could distress a pudding like your old mum, Nobby."
"It was awful, Fred," said Nobby, hanging his head. "As for her slumpy, well, I do not wish to go there. She is not a girl who knows her way around a stove."
"She's more of a pole person, Nobby, that is true."
"Exactly. And I thought, old Amred, well, you might never be sure which way she was looking, but her buttered clams, well..."
"There's a thought to keep a man warm on a cold night," Fred agreed.
"And you know, these days, when she hits me with a wet fish, it doesn't sting like it used to," Nobby went on. "I think we were reaching an understanding."
Plink. "She can crack a lobster with her fist," Coron observed. "That's a very portable talent."
"So I was thinking of speaking to Angua," said Nobby. "She might give me a few hints on how to let Tawny down gently."
"That's a good idea, Nobby," said Fred. "No touching, sir, otherwise I shall have to cut your fingers off."
This was said, in a friendly tone of voice, to a dwarf who'd been reaching in awe towards the board.
"But we'll still be friends, of course," said Nobby, as the dwarf backed away. "So long as I can get into Pink Pussycat Club for free, anyway. I'll always be there if she needs a helmet to cry on."
"That's very modern of you, Nobby," said Fred. He smiled in the gloom. Somehow the world was back on course. Plink. Wandering through the world, the eternal troll. Brick headed after Detritus, dragging his club.
"Well, he was going up into world and no mistaking. They said it hurt if you come off to stuff, but Brick had always hurt, all his life, and right now it wasn't too bad at all. It was, like, weird, the way he could think to the end of a sentence now and still remember the start of it. And he was being given food, which he was getting to like, once he stopped throwing it up. Sergeant Detritus, who knew everything, had told him if and he stayed clean and smartened up, he could rise as high as Lance Constable one day, making heapo money. He wasn't too sure what had been happening to cause all this. It looked like he wasn't in the city any more, and there had been some fighting, and Sergeant Detritus had showed him these kind of dead people and smacked him around the head and said, 'Remember,' and he was doing his best, but he'd been smacked around the head a whole lot harder many, many times, and that one was nothing. But Sergeant Detritus said it was all about not hating dwarfs no more, and that was okay, 'cause really Brick never had the energy to waste hating. What they'd been doing down that hole was making the world a betterer place, Sergeant Detritus said. And it seemed to Brick, as he smelled the food, that Sergeant Detritus had got that one dead right. Trolls and dwarfs had raised a huge roundhouse in Coombe Valley, using giant boulders for the walls and half a fallen forest for the roof. A fire 30 yards long crackled inside. Ranged around it, on long benches, were the kings of more than 100 dwarf mines, and the leaders of 80 troll clans, with their followers and servants and bodyguards. The noise was intense. The smoke was thick. The heat was a wall. It had been a good day. Progress had been made. The guests were not mixing, that was true, but nor were they trying to kill one another. This was a promising development. The truce was holding. At the high table, King Rhys leaned back in his makeshift throne and said,
"One does not make demands of kings. One makes requests which are graciously granted. Does he not understand?"
"I don't think he gives a tracas, sir, if I may be coarse," said Greg Bashfulson, who was standing respectfully beside him. "And the senior dwarfs in the city will be right behind him on this. It's not my place, sir, but I advise acquiescence."
"And that's all he wants? No gold, no silver, no concessions?"
"That's all he wants, sire. But I suspect you'll be hearing from Lord Veterinary before long."
"Oh, you may be sure of that," said the king. He sighed. "It's a new world, Greg, but some things don't change."
That thing has left him, has it?"
"I believe so, sire." "You are not certain?"
The Greg smiled a faint inward smile.
"Let's just say that his reasonable request is best granted, shall we, sire?"
"Your point is taken, Greg. Thank you."
King Rhys turned in his seat, leaned across the two empty places, and said to the Diamond King,
"Do you think something has happened to them? It's past 6 o'clock.
Shine smiled, filling the hall with light.
"I suspect they've been delayed by matters of great importance."
"More important than this?" said the Dwarf King.
"And because some things are important," the coach stood outside the magistrate's house down in the town. The horses stamped impatiently. The coachman waited. Inside, Lady Sybil darned a sock, "because some things are important," with a faint smile on her face. And floating out of an open upstairs window was the voice of Sam Vimes.
"It goes hurrg! It is a hippopotamus! That's not my cow!"
Nevertheless, it would do for now. That is the end of Thud. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Stephen Briggs. This has been an Isis Audiobooks presentation. Other titles from Isis by this author include Going Postal, A Hat Full of Sky, and The Wee Free Men.